This is Tripwire Week in Review for week ending April 22nd, 2022. I'm Martha Kocher with Trep, a data modeling and analytics firm for the CMBS, commercial real estate, and CLO markets. I'm with our experts, Manus Clancy, Senior Managing Director, and Lonnie Henry, Head of CRE and Advisory Services. This week, Fed Chair Powell signaled a half percentage point increase at its Fed meeting next month, and the mask debate is reignited after a judge ends the nation's mask mandate. In economic news, upbeat outlooks from airlines, regional manufacturing activity from the Mid-Atlantic was a miss in April, and housing starts and building permits increased in March, while single-family housing fell. Manus, it was definitely a mixed bag this week, but the upshot does seem to point to uncertainty, and the markets definitely reacted.
There was a few surprises this week. Let me start with the biggest one, which is the amazing resilience we've seen in the economy in the face of 200 basis points in rate increases at the short end of the curve and maybe 125 at the long end of the curve. You would think at this point we would see a dampening of economic activity. And to be sure, we've seen kind of a rocky spell for stocks, particularly tech stocks. The NASDAQ has been down both for the month and year to date so far. But everywhere else you look, it really seems like this is kind of like a running back, you know, running down the field and just kind of tacklers just kind of bouncing off him with no impact whatsoever. And when you look at the conference board's number today of leading economic indicators, you know, held pretty steady, came in at where you would expect. Earnings, aside from the dismal numbers on subscribers put out by Netflix, have been pretty good. When you scratch beneath the surface into what we're really interested in, which is commercial real estate, leasing, sales, economic activity, and everything else have really, really continued apace. And one data point, you know, for us to look at is conduit issuance, which was really muted in 2021, right? Kind of was left behind in the surge of issuance we saw last year. Well, first quarter of 2022, up more than 50%. And even if you go through and project to where we'll be at the end of April, it'll still be up over 40% from where we were last year. So even though these storm clouds are out there, whether it's the war in the Ukraine, rising interest rates, high inflation numbers, the broader economy just seems to be stiff-arming these concerns away for the time being.
Yeah, I think you summed that up really nicely, Manus. It's interesting. Any of those things on their own in years past could have disrupted the markets. And it seems like at this point, we're in a tsunami of uncertainty and bad news, and things seem to just keep trucking along. A couple of bullets that Martha had mentioned earlier, you know, in terms of economic news, the mask mandate. I was actually on a plane flying to New York this week on Monday when the federal judge overturned the mask mandate. And so they announced on the flight that you no longer had to wear your mask was greeted with cheers. So I think even though the Justice Department's filed an appeal to try to overturn that ruling, it's going to be really hard to go back on that. You know, people were already disruptive on flights, in the airports, you know, able to eat and drink at airport bars without wearing masks. And now that they've had a week or so of not having to wear them on the flights, I think it's going to be really hard pressed to get that back. Interesting takeaway from that, TSA checkpoint numbers were only off 4% from the 2019 numbers this last weekend, which, you know, pretty much puts us back on track pre-COVID. A couple of other things that I thought was interesting this week, the U.S. home building unexpectedly rose in March, but starts for single-family housing tumbled against the rising interest rates. So to put that in perspective, it's a record number backlog of houses approved for construction that have yet to be started. I think that spells some additional supply constraint concerns heading into the next couple of months. We're starting to see, I saw KB Homes and a few other large builders that said they're going to stop construction in certain areas. Existing home sales reached seasonally adjusted annual rate of 5.77 million in March, which was down 2.7% from February and 4.5% lower than last year. So just a couple of other things that maybe don't rise to the top of the headlines, but we're dealing with in real time here with the market.
And there were a couple of things that got my attention as we look a little bit behind the scenes. You know, Lonnie, you started to look at some of this with your commentary. As of about 3 o'clock today, the 30-year fixed rate mortgage rate, 5.27, up another 12 basis points. And I'll put this in the same category as where I kicked off, which is that doesn't seem yet to be tapering down the boil of this economy, even though I think, I don't know, 2 years ago, you can get a mortgage in the twos. Even a year ago, you were probably low to mid threes. Now, you know, sometimes that average US number, if you shop around, you could do 40 or 50 basis points better. So let's say you could still do 4.75. That's still significantly higher than where we were a year ago, yet it doesn't seem like any of this has had an impact yet. A couple of other data points that kind of caught my eye today. Before the sell-off late Thursday, and we're recording this on an April 21st, Thursday afternoon after the close of business, we saw another sizable sell-off today in stocks. But earlier in the day, the Dow had hit its highest level since February 10th, which is before we saw some of these shockingly high inflation numbers and before the war in Eastern Europe began. So I know the NASDAQ is down considerably since that time. The S&P hasn't been able to keep up with the Dow. But the fact that the Dow is up in the face of all these headwinds is just another example of the market kind of deflecting an awful lot of negative news so far.
We also saw CREFC put out their CRE sentiment survey, and it's definitely a reversal from the last quarter when they did the survey. And I would say decidedly negative would be kind of the headline there. They basically went from 65% being positive on the economy in the fourth quarter of 2021 to now 75% feeling the economy is going to worsen.
Well, I think people are reacting to the headlines, which have been dreadful, right, for the last 2 months. Anytime you're talking about double-digit inflation, war, and surging interest rates, you know, that'll take a bite out of your confidence level. The same is true of the wealth effect. If you start to see stocks down between 10 and 20%, which is where we saw the NASDAQ at one point over the last month. But back to my earlier point, the data does not suggest that we are in a bad spot. On the spread level, CMBS spreads have stayed range-bound and haven't really moved up since the beginning of the war in Ukraine. You know, there was a spike in late February and early March. We haven't seen much more widening since then. Issuance has continued apace, and we've already posted very healthy numbers for Q1. It looks like we are on the path to having really, really healthy numbers for Q2 as well, including the conduit space that was beat up last year. And the pace at which transactions are taking place across all property types, not just industrial, grocery anchored, and multifamily, really suggests that there's a lot more confidence behind the scenes than what people are telling us in our surveys, or in this case, the CREFC survey.
I think it's interesting because I would agree with Manus. The data doesn't support, you know, the sentiment that's being expressed in this survey. But I would say when you're on the tail end of a bull run, a lot of times the sentiment is a precursor to the data. You know, so we're 12 years into what's generally a 7-year cycle, especially on the transaction market. I mean, we talk every week on record-setting prices for all asset classes. I think in the last month, we've talked about hotels, multifamily offices that have all set record prices in secondary and tertiary markets, not just the top five markets in the U.S. And so it was the same thing in 2008 where, you know, nobody thought it was going to stop until one day it just stops. And I don't know if we're in a different environment now because the federal government has intervened so much. The people maybe have a different sense of what risk really is, because anytime there's been something that should, you know, be systemic or impact the CRE market at large, there's been intervention to help support that. So I think, you know, I wouldn't be shocked if we start seeing more of these surveys come out to the negative. The one, you know, positive takeaway here is that while the sentiment was negative, the board didn't foresee liquidity concerns. So I know, Manish, you've talked at length about you know, the real crisis in 08 was a lack of liquidity in the market and you just couldn't get anything done. You know, that doesn't seem to be a concern for them at this point. If that's not a concern, and if that doesn't actually play out where there is a liquidity event, you know, the market should rebound, even if it does slow down a little bit due to some of these external macro forces.
Yeah, it's an interesting time to be sure, because for the last 10 years, you know, the Fed has really, probably even more, I guess now we're probably talking the last 13 years, the Fed has shown no inclination towards any kind of hawkishness. And you could even go back to the mid-90s, really the last time they showed any real appetite for this. And now they seem to be going a little bit overboard with, we're not kidding this time, right? Earlier this week, Bullard, can't remember if he's a former Fed member or a current Fed member, said that he thinks a 75 basis point increase would be appropriate. Fed Chair Powell out today at a conference saying that, you know, 50 seems to be appropriate. And I was surprised. The market sold off real hard after his comments today. And you would think after, you know, telling us four or five times that this time he means business, that the market watchers, investors, traders, et cetera, would have taken him at his word. But it seems like there's a fair amount of skepticism that while he's saying these things, he doesn't really mean 11 rate hikes in the next 24 months really means 11 rate hikes.
Yeah, you were quoting Bullard, who's the St. Louis president Fed, and he came out extremely hawkish at a presentation that he gave where he said, you know, essentially, and I think you saw a couple people paraphrase it saying that we're behind the curve. The Fed's behind the curve on this.
You know, I had a dog once that used to bite people all the time when they came in. And after a couple of months, you know, we got used to meeting people on our front porch and telling them, you know, please don't pet the dog. The dog's a little bit nasty and it may bite you if you try to pet it. And even with that warning, I would say 50% of the people that came in our house chose to pet the dog anyway, and they would get nipped. And, you know, we would scratch our head and kind of say to them, if we knew them well enough and we could joke around, you know, what part of our warning did you not understand? And I feel like Bullard is me and my wife on the porch today kind of saying, you know, this rate hike is going to bite and you may want to take a little cover now. And investors are just kind of walking in and petting the dog still.
Let's go into property news. And we have a lot of office stuff to cover. So let's start with that.
Yeah, why don't we start with some of the green shoots that we saw this week, some of which touch CMBS and some don't. But it all kind of comes back to the open that we all three of us kind of talked about, which is the pace at which the economy is moving and how things are happening right now is at a level which doesn't suggest a lack of confidence. So let's start off with this first one. Wilson, Sonsini, Goodrich, and Rosati, they're the Bay Area's largest law firm by headcount. They renewed at their Palo Alto headquarters, a real vote of confidence for that part of the market. And I'm sorry, I don't have the author of that particular story. They renewed not just for a sizable portion, almost 200,000 square feet, but they signed on for 17 years. So this isn't a case where they're renewing, but saying, let's take 5 years and see where we are after that. You know, it's a real vote of confidence. And the landlord there is Commonwealth Partners. And by the way, that was, I finally found it, a real deal story. A couple of others, Blackstone signed on for 200,000 square feet in Midtown Manhattan. They're signing on for 601 Lexington Avenue, which backs a big CMBS loan. That loan had seen occupancy dip into the 70s. Blackstone already has a presence in that building, and this will take them from 100,000 square feet to 300,000 square feet, and that's near Grand Central Station. And lastly, this was another one we liked in the Steel City, bringing up reminiscings of Steel City Dave, Real Estate Business Online reporting that law firm Dickey, McCarney, and Chilcott has signed on for 80,000 square feet at 4 Gateway Center. That's in downtown Pittsburgh. The property has 1.4 million square feet and backs a $99 million CMBS loan. So activity really from coast to coast, and happy to be reporting it.
Man, as you talked about the law firm in San Francisco signing a 17-year lease, I'd really like to know what those escalation clauses look like over that lease term. Because I think in this market, especially in San Francisco, if you're the property owner, you're probably willing to take that risk given all of the negative CRE activity that's taking place there. If you're the tenant, though, you probably are feeling like you got a really sweet deal if you're willing to sign on for 17 years in today's environment. So I'd love to see a little more detail on that one. But transitioning, we have SL Green Realty Corp entered an agreement to buy a luxury office tower in Manhattan's Plaza District. It's the largest transaction so far this year in the borough. Midtown's resurging demand for high quality space. Manhattan's largest office landlord will pay, it's reported, $445 million to Oxford Properties for 450 Park Avenue. It's expected to close the second quarter, marks the REIT's first office purchase since 2018. And CBRE's Darcy Stakeham and William Shanahan and Doug Middleton advised the seller. This was from the commercial property executive. Interesting tidbit on this, the 32,000 square foot retail component is going to actually have the first Manhattan luxury showroom for UK manufacturer Aston Martin as a tenant. So they're going to occupy some of that ground floor retail space. So our friend and listener, Scott B., should probably go check out the Aston Martin dealership. It's a little bit outside of my price range, but I heard he may be in the market for one of those cars. So other tenants include BDT Capital Partners and Oxford Properties.
Well, I always joke that I'll never buy a car that will make me cry once, one of those shopping carts runs into it outside the shop, right? You know, that's my level. If I buy a car and that happens on day two, I want to know that I'm not going to care two bits that it happened. That's kind of my automobile purchasing history.
I wouldn't even buy an Aston Martin and Gran Turismo on the PlayStation, so let alone in real life.
So moving on, we've got some crabgrass in the office sector.
Yeah, this is a part of the market that has really lagged for a while. The headline in this particular case, the REIT Empire State has decided that it is throwing in the towel on Merritt View in Norwalk, Connecticut. We've seen some CMBS loans there over the last 10 years where tenants have fled either to other parts of that part of Connecticut or to leave the state altogether. In this particular case, occupancy has been lagging and the REIT has decided to throw back the keys. But as you can tell from our tenor thus far, green shoots outpacing crabgrass by about a 5 or 6 to 1 ratio this week. And I think we've had more time and more inclination to roll out more stories. I think that the positive to negative ratio is probably more like 15 to 1 this week than 4 or 5 to 1.
It was interesting on this one, Manus. The CEO, Tony Malkin, was actually quoted as saying, better for us to put that capital elsewhere. We decided to walk from the property. There was no story. This was pretty much just black and white for them. They felt like this building was obsolete. They lowered the rent significantly below what they thought market was in the previous year with no tenants, seeking the space. And so they just felt like they needed to walk away from the property. We have talked about this, while on a smaller scale, I think we're going to start seeing this in those older, obsolete type of office buildings. This may be the start of something. This is clearly not Midtown or one of the major markets, but, definitely something to keep an eye on.
There's no crying in baseball. Tom Hanks told us that in the Great League of Their Own movie. And for those that may not know this already, most of our listeners probably do, there's no crying in real estate either. When owners choose to throw in the keys, it's really X's and O's, right? It's how much is this building throwing off? How much more will I get out of it if I put in another 5 to 10 million refurbishing it? What is my return on capital? And can this 5 or 10 million that I might deploy here be better used in another purchase or another refurbishing elsewhere? So Tom Hanks doesn't cry in that movie, and I don't think Sam Zell or any of the other Uber developers over the years shed a lot of tears when they lose a building. It's all just part of the landscape.
Next story, I think, is going to take us to Chicago.
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. More bad news for Chicago. So I don't know if this is Krabby Crabgrass, but CNO Financial Group will move into 303 East Wacker Drive, for a smaller office shedding more than 100,000 square foot of space. Another downsizing, CNO Financial Group, the parent company of Insurers, Bankers Life, and Colonial Penn, signed a lease for 32,000 plus square feet at 303 East Wacker Drive. It's going to move next year from 111 East Wacker. It will exit the 139,000 square foot lease that they have in place at 111 and then consolidate down to the 32,000 square foot that we mentioned there on 303 East Wacker. So it's just another big loss for New York-based AmTrust, the owner of the Field Building at 135 South LaSalle. So CNO is the largest tenant in 111 East Wacker property. It generated about $13 million in net cash flow through the first 9 months of 21, with debt service of just about $12 million during that period. That was Crane's reporting on that one. It backs a $260 million loan on the property.
To your point, Lonnie, this is an important story on two levels. One is the downsizing, you know, the firm taking a 75% haircut to their space in Chicago. That $260 million loan is part of CMBX 9, and part of that loan represents 13% of one deal and 11% of another. So this is one to watch. That lease ends in August 2023. And DSCR, even before this forthcoming vacancy, only 61%. If you throw this on top of what is already low occupancy and a DSCR of only 1.01x on this particular property, something that CMBX 9 longs and shorts may want to watch, as well as CMBS investors down the curve in the three deals that have pieces of this loan.
So let's round out our crabgrass here. We got a story from Cleveland where they see 1 million square foot of, in quotations, zombie office space removed from inventory. This was one of our CRE Direct stories this week where we highlight the million square foot of space being taken off the market. So this one is actually, you know, could be crabgrass or potentially a green shoot, depending on how you look at it. But basically, the office vacancy percentage in Cleveland has been very high over the last couple of years. It looks like Newmark had reported that there was, you know, significant vacancy with the removal of this zombie space. And I'll get to that in just a second. The fourth quarter of 2020, it was about 17.6%, which is 7.25% lower than the 19.3% office vacancy in the fourth quarter of last year. What makes this unique is they're taking it off the market, not because they don't feel it's no longer viable in the space. They just don't think it's viable as office space, but there are suitors for that space and other uses. So there's a couple of redevelopments happening. So among the properties being redeveloped, one of them is going into apartments. There's about a 496,000 square foot office building at 45 Erie View Plaza, which is going to be converted to a 365 unit apartment complex. The developer on that one was Blue Lofts Inc. of Dallas. They paid about $22 million for the space. They had another redevelopment that's happening at 1301 East 9th Street, where they're taking 740,000 square foot of office space, reducing that down to a more manageable 300,000 square foot, and then taking the remainder and turning it into a 210-room hotel. With an additional 200 units of apartments. That's a $90 million project led by affiliate of a local developer there, Kasuf Real Estate Company. So I think in this instance, you know, the headline grabs you, but the reality is the marketplace has pivoted a little bit and made better use of these locations. One other tidbit there, the city in Cleveland hasn't seen a new office delivery since the first quarter of 2020, when Convergent East was added with a 60,000 square foot office at 3005 Clemens Road. But right now there are three new office buildings totaling about 332,000 square foot in the construction pipeline, according to Newmark, that should be delivered in Cleveland in the upcoming couple of quarters.
And the last story we'll cover allows me to mention our guest pod that we had this week with Matthew Osborne from Eastern Bank. One of the topics we talked about was the life sciences sector and how it's essentially driving interest from investors looking for properties that serve those types of firms and organizations.
The life science space has been terrific in so many cities. We talked about it with Oz earlier this week, which was a terrific back and forth. We're really happy to have him. But he talked about how strong life science has been in Cambridge and in Boston more generally. That market for a long time has really been a magnet for life science space. we've now seen that really start to expand into San Diego and other areas as well. And I think we mentioned this a week or two ago that not only will people pay up for space that they think can be reconverted into life science destinations and campuses and so forth, they'll pay a fortune for that. We saw in California, one developer pay, I think, over $300 million for a couple different parcels of a shopping mall with the intention of tearing down the entire complex and replacing it with life science. That's not the only example we've seen, but it just goes to show the strength of what they think the bid is for space for would-be tenants, for space that is dedicated to that type of use.
Yeah, we've seen this with life science, data centers, cold storage. They carve a little niche out for themselves within the CRE property sector, and then, you know, the prices just go through the roof. So we talked a little bit about Pegasus Place in Dallas, which was a former ExxonMobil campus that they've converted to a life science building. And so I think after Matt's, you know, discussion on the podcast, seeing this transaction of life science in Philadelphia, $45 million is pretty, pretty significant and just highlights the sentiment in the marketplace.
Yeah, I think we didn't mention any details about that, but that was Chicago Real Estate Investment Trust that purchased the building that has both CHOP, which is the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and University of Pennsylvania as the anchor tenants. And that property sold, it was a 118 square foot building in the University City of Philly, sold for $45 million. So again, underscores some of the interest we've talked about in this space. We have a segment that did so well last week that Manus, we're doing it again. Brokers, start your engines.
Cue up the sound effect, Haley. I don't know if it got in there last week or not, but this too, like the story in Cleveland that Lonnie referred to before, is it crabgrass or is it green shoots? Hard to say, but it was the Philadelphia Business Journal, Natalie Castelny, who I've been following for years, who does great reporting for that publication. She noted that 6 Penn Center in Philly at 1701 Market Street has been put up for sale. The interesting thing there is that the sale is going to take place, or is, you know, the seller is hoping it will take place, even though the top tenant, law firm Morgan Lewis, will be vacating. It's a sizable tenant at that property. Thus far, the owners have found no tenants to fill that sizable footprint that the law firm has. The building itself has about 300,000 square feet, and look for it to hit the market quite soon.
You know, what's interesting about that, Manus, is with the marketplace for industrial property specifically so hot, sometimes the buildings, a lot of times the buildings are worth more if they were vacant, because current market rent is significantly higher than what the lease is from an encumbrance perspective. We haven't seen that be the case, though, in office buildings. So when they say they're taking an office with substantial vacancy to the market, you know, it makes you scratch your head a little bit, because the odds of them signing somebody at a higher rental rate is probably not great.
And moving on to retail, we had a story that was generated from a trading alert that we published via Tripwire.
Yes, this is par for the course, I guess. Over the last 2 years, we've talked about CMBS mall loan purgatory, and we put out a trading alert on two loans from the same deal. Both are from a JP Morgan 2012 C6 securitization. The two loans together make up about almost 75% of the remaining collateral behind those deals. That deal itself is part of CMBX 6. In more similarities, both properties are owned by CBL, which is the REIT that filed for bankruptcy a year or so ago. They had been in this purgatory, which kind of played out in many levels. Purgatory number one being, we didn't know what CBL would do with them at a bankruptcy. Number two is they were going to struggle getting refinanced. And number three is, you know, demand for malls for purchase is quite tepid. But special servicer comments this month for both loans revealed that modifications have been negotiated and are in the process of being documented. For CMBX longs that like taking insurance premiums every month and want these loans to stay in a period of extended pretend for as long as possible, this is tremendous news. In fact, we did see CMBX 6 triple B minus tighten after our press release or our trading alert went out. And, you know, the news probably means that maturity date extensions are forthcoming. One was the Arbor Place Mall in Douglasville, Georgia. It backs a $100 million loan. The mall itself, 1.1 million square feet. The other property is in North Charleston, SC, and that is the Northwoods Mall. It backs a $60.2 million note. And as I said, good news for CMBX longs. Disappointing news for CMBX 6 shorts, who probably were hoping that these would be resolved quickly and with sizable losses. Doesn't seem like that'll be the case.
I'm thankful that we've finally checked the box for this week's podcast. We can now officially call this a Tripwire Weekend Review because we've had a CMBS and CMBX mall story. I think we have one every week, so I'm glad we got this one as well.
So going back to our original theme that, you know, economic activity continues to just be extraordinarily robust. Two other stories that caught our attention this week in the retail space. One was that Federal Realty Investment Trust has acquired Kingstown Town Center. That is made up of about 400,000 square feet in Kingstown, VA. The story comes from Commercial Observer. The purchase price was $200 million, and the seller was the Halley Companies. Both properties, both adjoining properties, are grocery anchored. So ongoing strength in that particular market. Other retailers, other tenants in the property, TJ Maxx, Ross, Home Goods, and a couple of restaurants. Why this one caught my attention is, number one, rising interest rates, seemingly no impact on demand for this particular type of property. And the tenant base is made up of the type of retailers that target middle-class type of customers, right? This isn't an Apple store. It isn't a, you know, a high-end Nordstrom Rack or Gucci bags. This is TJ Maxx, Ross, and Home Goods, and yet still a very, very healthy premium price for this asset, even as interest rates go up. The other story, this one is in Chicago suburbs of Naperville, a shopping center there, the Naperville Plaza, sold for $52 million. Why did this get my attention? Well, it has sold twice in the last 4 years, most recently at a 44% premium to where it was at the end of 2020. So if we haven't bludgeoned you with the theme this week, which is all this negative economic headline worries not pulling the rug out from economic activity, here are two more stories to bludgeon you once and for all.
And in that theme, we are going to roll into a sector that's been doing very well, which is student housing. And it's a sector within the multifamily space that continues to do well and had a couple stories that we saw that were pretty interesting.
Well, I think we have to throw this one over to Lonnie as he spends more time on campus than any of us do, being a professor.
I only pay tuition, Manus. That's all I'm allowed to do.
Well, we do tuition. And I joke, this is kind of a dark humor type thing that I used to tell people when I was, you know, 15 years ago when I was saving up, that with my luck, my head would hit the desk the minute after I had written that last tuition check, right? That's when they would take me out on a gurney. And having not written that last tuition check yet, I guess it's still in the realm of possibility. But let's throw it over to you, Lonnie. What do you see in the student housing market this week?
Well, student housing is an interesting segment. And I think we had a lot of research and content from the TREP perspective right when the onset of the pandemic hit, because we weren't sure what to think of the student housing market. They were closing college campuses, shifting to remote learning. I lived through that as an adjunct instructor of our classes being shifted to online presence immediately. But this week, we kind of saw what the market perceives of that marketplace. So the first story we're going to talk about is a deal between Blackstone and American Campus Communities. So ACC, as it's known, is an Austin, Texas-based publicly traded student housing REIT. And Blackstone acquired the REIT this week for $12.8 billion, including debt. Blackstone was then quoted as saying, "We think student housing is a compelling sector because it's performed through cycles and has been really quite resilient over time." A little bit about the ACC portfolio. They own 166 buildings in cities and college towns across the U.S. I think what makes them a little bit unique is a lot of their buildings are on campus. So they have agreements in place with the operators of the campus. So they have really high quality buildings and really great locations at some really high-end universities. So a couple of the more notable campus facilities are Arizona State University and the University of California, Berkeley. We have a lot of their data in our TREP system. A lot of their debt was financed using CMBS loans. So this is a really, I think, a bold move for the sector and really sets kind of a high watermark from Blackstone from a transaction perspective at about $13 billion.
You know, Blackstone really just seems to have insatiable appetite across the board, and I guess it makes sense. They have deep pockets, and their cost of funding is significantly less than what you would see for other medium-sized operators or operators without their track record. It's funny, when I saw that they bought American Campus, my first thought was they're halfway through the A's, right? They're going through and they're buying everything that they possibly can, and now they're halfway through the A's. And when they're done with this, they'll move on to the B's. But a couple of the points on student housing, you know, number one is I would think that, and I'm just kind of talking off the top of my head, but if I'm putting myself in Blackstone's shoes, I'm thinking student housing is one of those areas that is inflation resilient, meaning that if parents didn't take their kids out of school during COVID and say, "You're coming home because we're not getting our money's worth. We're not letting you sit in a dorm and take classes remotely when you can be sitting here in our basement doing it, and we could save significant money." I think that they probably figure that parents won't balk at 7% and 8% rate hikes year after year after year. And that probably makes sense. And when you throw in the fact that they're probably 50 to 100 basis points less in cost of funding from either American Campus or any of their competitors, and you lever this up, this is probably a home run type of deal for them.
And there were two more transactions that we were going to mention, probably not representative of all of them, but interesting. They take us from Florida all the way to Illinois.
Yeah, we'll run through these very quickly. It just goes to show that, you know, we're seeing transactions everywhere from the leasing side to the purchase side, from hotels to offices to retail, really across the board. In addition to that American Campus housing mega deal, we saw Core Spaces acquire a 400-bed campus in Tampa. It's near the University of South Florida. FPA Multifamily was the seller. Multifamily Housing News had the report on that. Core Spaces paid $39 million for the asset. And in Champaign, Illinois, Fairlawn Capital has purchased a 50-property portfolio in Champaign, Illinois. That would be the home of the University of Illinois. Purchase price there, $150 million. The deal was brokered by Marcus and Millichap. Why this one caught my attention is that I think we've seen a fair amount of distress in the Champaign and Illinois area. We haven't seen a whole lot of distress in the student housing market for the last 2 years. It defied or at least my expectations. But some of the distress we saw was in that marketplace. And here you have a firm coming in and paying $150 million in that market. So good on them.
Yeah, this was an interesting story too, Manus, because this was basically an aggregation of different assets used for student housing. So this was a sale that included single family homes to student housing communities. Newest construction on that portfolio was 2019. But they do have some older properties that were over 50 years old. So this was an interesting sale because it wasn't a traditional student housing complex in terms of how the composition was. It actually had some single family rentals and smaller student housing components to it.
And a couple of quick hits on hotels. The first story is of our mixed greens variety. I'm not sure what variety you like, Manus. A little arugula, a little spinach, a little romaine.
Well, you know, us Irish guys, we're really kind of dedicated to the spud.
I thought you were going to say cabbage. I was like, ooh.
Well, I do like cabbage. I'm a big fan of cabbage and spinach, you know, but it's, you know, when you go to the meat and three down here, down south, you know, sometimes it's getting the mashed potato, the baked potato, and the French fries, right? Those are the three yes. sides that you get.
That's great.
I'm okay with that. That's, you know, one of our longtime listeners, Sully up in Hartford, Connecticut, he introduced me to the meat and three spuds selection.
It's a rounded meal. Rounded meal makes for rounded waistlines.
Yeah, there we go.
So we had a survey of members of the Hospitality Asset Managers Association. And, you know, they're optimistic in some ways, but not in others. So positive on predictive RevPAR, and they think it's going to reach 2019 levels by 2023. So we should see that some point soon, especially with all the positive news of expectations of travel coming from the airlines. The problem, they say, is going to be understaffed problems of, you know, not having enough people. And that's their top worry.
Yeah, and I don't think they're alone. I can't remember if it was Brookfield or Blackstone today. One of their CEOs was on CNBC this afternoon, and they said, you know, the wage pressure is everywhere. Right. And they would know, right? They're in every property type, every segment, and they would be in every part of the country. They'd be seeing it everywhere. I do, generally speaking, agree with the sentiment that I'm seeing. I know that, you know, I travel quite a bit around the US, and I feel like I'm paying twice per night compared to what I was paying a year ago. I think demand is quite high. You know, the hotel bars seem to be full. Periodically, you run into a hotel with no rooms. And so I think the sentiment is good. I do think, and we'll talk about this in a minute, there's still just pockets of misery in a couple of markets. But by and large, when you talk about vacation destinations, the coastlines, the South, the Southeast, college towns, I think they're doing, you know, they're not completely back to 2019, but they're grinding it out and they're making a living. Good for them.
Yeah, so Manish, you mentioned pockets of pain. Something to highlight that we have Host Hotels and Resorts sold Sheraton New York Times Square for $373 million, which may sound like a pretty big price tag, but it's only $210,000 per room. That was a deal with MCR and Island Capital Group. Not a good sign for New York type of hotel sales, especially in light. I think we saw a hotel sale in Nashville this week. It was either the W or the Westin that traded for $950,000 per room. So Times Square Hotel for $210,000 just shows that not all pockets have recovered. And so it'll be interesting to see how these play themselves out. The ones that are not viable, or the person that buys this for $373 million, are they going to continue use as a hotel and try to rebrand it? Are they going to convert it to some other type of alternative use? I didn't see that in the story. But for every positive story, you know, maybe a small subset of those are somewhat negative. And this will be one of those that just shows it's still not back to what it was pre-pandemic.
You know, the metrics that you see in New York and Chicago, two areas that were really hard hit, are incredibly consistent for that everyman hotel, right? The everyman being the big hotel, national chain, not a boutique, you know, not something kind of new and sexy or whatever. Those hotels were really getting about $450,000 per key from 2008 to 2015, give or take, kind of held that level for another couple of years. The glut took a little bit out of them, but now we're in distress in those markets. That $200,000 per key seems to be the high watermark, right? Somewhere between $190,000 and $210,000 in both the Windy City and the Big Apple.
So let's turn to shout outs. We had a Twitter follower make a comment about IO.
Yes. Last week we talked, we made a call that, you know, IO bonds might be interesting right now if we expect extend and pretend to be the narrative for the next couple of years. And we had one Twitter follower basically bring up via Twitter conversation some nuances in that market. We thought we would have time to get into some more detail on that this week, but fear not, we're going to do that. We're running a little bit late this week. Fear not, we're going to come back with more nuance on that particular market. And the short answer is we generally agree with this person's comments, but we'll talk more about it next Thursday.
And Mike M., who I think, Lonnie, is a kindred spirit of yours. He's a CRE valuation guy in the private equity world. He says the pod's great. He requested information on our risk retention and interest rate reports that we published. Bill C., was honored to meet me, which I thought was interesting, and talked about Manus as if he was a celebrity. He is someone that was recently brought on board at TREP. So I guess our reputation precedes us there. Chris P was excited about the episode for Matthew Osborne, which, as we mentioned, was just dropped this week. So we should have a listen to that. Private Eye Capital on Twitter responded to our multifamily NOI discussion with some good comments. He mentioned 2021 NOI growth was a function of leases signed at the depths of COVID, and inflation has not yet been a meaningful factor. And you can see this by going through their filings. I know a number of REITs are going to report earnings next week. So we're going to do a little bit of a dive into some of their performance and hopefully underscore what Private Eye is talking about. Avid Car podcast listener, interesting handle there, left us a review on Apple Podcasts, loves the show, wanted to get information on one of our stories. We can't do that via Apple, but if you send us your email, we'll be happy to send you any of the reports we've talked about. And our old buddy Joe M gave us a little bit of ribbing. He said, we missed a layup with you, Manus, when you mentioned video stores. And Lonnie and I didn't take the bait and give you a little bit of a hard time on video stores, which of course have been defunct, except for the immersive experience of Blockbuster that's in Bend, Oregon.
Yes, the last one that exists. You know, I'm a guy who used to play a little basketball here and there with Joe. We used to have corporate basketball on Thursday nights. So I was going to say Joe knows a thing or two about missing layups, but it's not really true. Joe's quite a basketball player. If anybody was missing layups, it was me. You know, I like to joke that I was the king of the triple single. One turnover, one missed free throw, and one technical foul. You know, some guys, some professionals rack up triple doubles. I was known for the ignominious triple single in my day.
I love that. Gotta love it. And Parker B is a huge supporter of the pod. He listens every Friday on his commute into work, and it gives him a weekend feel. I couldn't agree more. Nothing feels like the weekend, like finishing up this pod late on a Thursday. So thanks for that. And, you know, in closing, Saturday is a national holiday that only music lovers can appreciate. In fact, Manus was the one that called attention to Record Store Day, which is Saturday. And you can get your reissued vinyl LPs from your favorite artists. I'm curious, which one would you go for?
Well, it's a wonderful day. And down in South Carolina here, there's a couple of great vintage record stores. And not only do they do re-releases, sometimes bands will release live recordings of things that had previously never been put out there. So, you know, it's a little bit of a feast for me on days like this when I go by and look for new stuff. But it did remind me of some old albums that I just really played until you kind of see through the ridges on, on the vinyl. Things like Boston's first album in 1976, More Than a Feeling, and Who's Next, and Darkness on the Edge of Town. Those would be some of the ones that, I played until you could kind of see through them.
Yeah, unfortunately, I feel very inadequate in this conversation because in my generation, we didn't have the vinyl. We had CDs, or later in my childhood, we were downloading illegal music on Napster. And unfortunately, none of the folks that I was listening to would probably rise to the level of the artist Manus mentioned, unless you consider Bone Thugs and Harmony, LL Cool J, or potentially Eminem in the mix. So I don't really add much value in this section of the pod today.
Well, I'll throw one more little slice of life thing in there, and I'll report back on it next week. For the first time in my life, I have backstage passes to a show this weekend. A buddy of mine, I don't know anything. You know, I have no connections, and I'm not a player, so to speak, but a buddy of mine has connections with this band. So I'm going to be backstage, and my dream is I'm going to wear my Trep pullover there, and somebody in the band is going to say, "Dude, you're the guy from the Trep podcasts," right? Instead of me saying, you know, "Oh, I'm so honored to see you. This is so great. I love this song." Instead of me drooling over them, they turn to me and go, "Oh my God, that podcast. I'm on the tour bus every Friday morning and listen to you guys, you know, And I'll report that back next week to see if that happens.
You'll have Manus, if you're out there and you see a Pixies LP live from Coachella 2004, pick me up one and I'll send you my expense account.
Yeah, I would have thought for you maybe Shauna and I, and for Lonnie, I don't know, maybe TLC or maybe, you know, somebody in that, you know, 90s genre.
Ouch. Wow. Ooh, with that, we'll close. Thanks to our producer, Haley Keene. Join us next week as we look at what's happened during the week and how it may be impacting you. If you have a question or a comment, send it to podcast@trep.com and subscribe to the podcast with your favorite provider. Thank you for listening and stay well.
All right.